Hey everybody, welcome to episode 13 of CreateCast, the show about people who make good. I'm your host, Chase K. Believe it or not, this is the final episode of season one. It's been an incredible run so far. It's been an absolute joy to put together, and I'm just really thankful to all the listeners and all of the amazing guests that we've had. But fear not, the show must go on, and CreateCast will be going on with a season two. In fact, I've almost recorded all of it. It's another set of incredible interviews, incredible people, amazing things, and I can't wait for you guys to hear it. So we're going to be taking a short break, maybe just a couple weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, and then we'll be back with brand new episodes and some amazing stuff. I'm really excited for you guys to hear it. As I always mention in our intros, please make sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to us on iTunes, and also make sure to visit us at createcastpod.com to sign up for our email newsletter. We're still doing our incredible giveaway, and I can't wait to select some winners. So, once again, rate, comment, and subscribe in the iTunes store, and please visit us at createcastpod.com to find out more about our incredible guests, the show, and sign up for our email newsletter. For you longtime listeners, you will remember that we did an interview with Kate Crater, the incredible restaurant editor from Food & Wine magazine. And in that interview, we talk about Chef Carlos Salgado, the chef from Taco Maria down in Newport Beach, California. He's working on some incredible Mexican food, and he was just named Food & Wine's Best New Chef of 2015, one of the 10. And he's a really great guy. He's worked at some incredible restaurants, and he's just an incredible chef. And I can't wait for you guys to hear what he has to say. And obviously, check him out online. I'm going to be linking to his website for Taco Maria in the description. And then obviously, if you're in the area, go eat his food. It's awesome. I mean, it's really good, so I love getting down there. And this interview with Chef Carlos Salgado was a lot of fun. And just one more time, a sincere thank you to all of our guests, all of our supporters and our listeners. I mean, everyone who backed the Kickstarter, everyone who's been listening to the show. I mean, even if this is your first episode, thanks for checking it out. It really means a lot. I care greatly about all of the people that I've interviewed, and I'm just honored to have the opportunity to talk to them. So, without any further ado and any more sappiness, here is our awesome interview with Chef Carlos Salgado of Taco Maria in Newport Beach, California. All right, hey everybody, we're here with Chef Carlos Salgado of Taco Maria in Costa Mesa. Chef Salgado is really awesome, and he's worked at some incredible restaurants, mainly as a pastry chef, correct?
That's right.
But, you know, Taco Maria is a little bit more savory, and he's also just been named one of Food & Wine's top 10 best new chefs this year, so huge congratulations. It's really awesome.
Thank you very much.
And so, just first off, thanks so much for taking the time to do this.
It's my pleasure.
So, I guess let's just start with it. Where did food sort of find its way into your life?
I grew up in a restaurant family, so my folks, about as far back as I can remember, have been in the restaurant business. Pretty soon after they had us, me and my sisters, they decided to go into business for themselves. And so I always had that, we always had that sort of restaurateur, entrepreneur influence in our family. Without knowing it, I was learning how to work for myself, just growing up in their restaurant. Hmm. So, in a lot of cultures, people don't really separate cooks from everyday normal people, and I think that that's true in our family and in our culture. My parents growing up in Mexico, there is no question as to whether you cooked. The question of like, oh, are you a cook, wasn't a question.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I even know with my family, you know, just a lot of sort of Southern tradition, and growing up just with my grandmother and my mother in the kitchen, it was just something that was so natural that it wasn't even really think about it. And I don't think my mom ever thought of it as, you know, oh, it's, we should teach him to cook. It's like, well, we have to cook. That's just what you do. I think that's really interesting. So obviously I just sort of mentioned how you worked as a pastry chef for a long time, and did you gravitate towards pastry? How did that work?
Well, actually, I had a fondness for pastry, and for sweets, for sure. early on when I started looking at cooking professionally. I was also very drawn, I was coming from an engineering and art background when I got into cooking professionally, and there was a certain appeal to the world of pastry that, you know, later I discovered could be applied to all of food, sweet and savory. But the process of the pastry kitchen, the discipline in the pastry kitchen, the precision, and the organization of multiple complex parts and processes to bring something together was really appealing to me. And so that was sort of the structure through which I learned how to cook professionally in kitchens. And so when the opportunity came up to work on the pastry side of a great restaurant that I started working at out of culinary school, I jumped on it. And the chef that I worked for at the time, his name is Vernon Morales. He had come from El Bulli, you know, which we all know is a legendary, modern restaurant. And he needed someone to fill the pastry chef role. He asked me if I could do it because I had spent some time helping the pastry chef there, and so of course I lied, and I said, "Of course I can do it." You know, I can make ice cream and I can do cakes and all that sort of thing. And so I remember distinctly, like, going home, you know, terrified at the lie that I had just told, and I spent my meager savings on all the cookbooks I could, and I came back. I told myself I was going to come back on Monday, a pastry chef, and so that's what I did.
That's incredible. And did you find, obviously, you know, when you're working maybe for another chef as a pastry chef, sort of the dessert side has to complement what the savory side is doing. Did you find that difficult, or how did you maybe balance that? How much of, I guess, would you say is sort of you creating, and how much of it was trying to sort of build something that fit the menu?
Well, I mean, I've been lucky enough to be the pastry chef of three restaurants, owned and operated by three tremendous chefs. And so I've had to adjust, you know, a little bit different working in every kitchen and working with every chef. Each of them was a teacher to me and a mentor to me. So I learned a great deal, but they also entrusted me a lot with the creativity of the menu. I essentially had carte blanche to do what I wanted with those pastry menus. And so for me, the approach that I took was to look at how they compose their menus, how they compose the savory aspect of their menus, and then use a similar ethic or philosophy to compose a dessert menu. Mm. So, for example, at the first restaurant that I was a pastry chef at, Winterland, was a very progressive sort of menu. It was kind of a mature take on the modernism that would later run its course through San Francisco, some of it misguided, some of it interesting, some of it, you know, even delicious. But this was an early time for that. This was before modernism in San Francisco. And Vernon was very playful and drew influence from all over the world. So I adapted my approach, or that's the approach that I took for crafting the menu. When I worked for Daniel Patterson, he's extremely thoughtful, very intellectual, and totally ingredient driven. I tried to use his method for determining what would be on the menu. Daniel would build a dish around a particular carrot from a particular farm, growing in a particular small window of the spring, let's say. And provenance is incredibly important to him, and the vitality of an ingredient is very important. So I sort of summoned those ideas when crafting the menu for Qua. And then when I was at Comi in Oakland working for James Sebu, mentor and also a close friend, his approach was similar, but a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for? A little bit more reckless in terms of the influences that he brought to bear in the menu. And so, you know, then I tried to, you know, sort of open up the my palette of ideas a little bit more and bring in some surprising elements.
Okay. Well, I think that's so cool just to see the sort of variety of influence that you were able to have working with so many obviously incredible chefs. Now that, moving sort of towards the savory, and obviously now that you have your own restaurant with Taca Maria, how do you find your own style? I mean, sort of take me through the creation of a dish. What happens for you? Where does it start?
Well, if I knew where it came from, I would go there more often.
I know it's a really hard question, I think, for sort of anyone who makes things. It's like, well, where does it come from? It's, I don't know, I just do it. But.
No, it is, but it's an important question for any creative person to ask themselves. Sort of try to understand the source and the origin of their ideas. And I think that for me, the Taca Maria and the menu at the restaurant is almost anthropological or ethnographic. I grew up, the son of Mexican restaurateurs who were doing food that was highly Americanized, modified to the American palate, and the sort of Tex-Mex flavor profiles that proliferated around the U.S. Over the last half century. And I didn't think much of that food when I was growing up. I didn't think much of my parents' work. I could even say that I was sort of, ashamed of the work that, to come from such humble sort of circumstances. I can say that openly because I feel much differently now. So the reason I preface with that is to say that for me, when I learned to appreciate my culture, it was through food. Realizing the richness and the complexity, the irreducible complexity of Mexican food, and the cultural richness, was really exciting. And so I had to, and I'm still working to discover that. And so the individual dishes on the menu, they'll come from different places. So often it'll be a specific memory of something that mom made. Right, so many great dishes start there. Other times, it'll be an ingredient that I'm really excited to work with, and so it takes some effort to find the proper context to with which to present it. Within the structure of a Mexican food menu. Other times, a dish will sort of start with one idea, and then. In the course of creating the set for the dish, we'll find that we want to take it in a completely different direction, and we'll end up with something that is only vaguely Mexican. But largely, I would say that probably my biggest influence was Qua and working with Daniel Patterson. I find that as I mature as a cook, I find my process to be more in line with the way that he worked and the way that his kitchen worked, which is to say that the best food starts with the best ingredients. That's that's basic and simple, but it shouldn't be taken for granted. The life that a great piece of produce or a great piece of meat or a beautiful piece of fish, the life that it has left in it once it's taken from the earth or from the ocean or from the fields, is temporary, and the deliciousness is sort of found in that, in the decay. I often like to say that as cooks, we work as sort of like more, our responsibilities are more like those of a mortician. Our responsibility is to see to the last final moments of something that was previously living and treat it with great respect and put forward an honest expression of its composition and its flavors. I find that increasingly the ingredient will tell me what the final dish will be.
I guess that sort of makes me wonder, just obviously, having, eaten at the restaurant a few times now and just thinking about a lot of the dishes, and you sort of mentioned ingredients, maybe there are some ingredients, you even mentioned sort of unconventional dishes that maybe don't, you know, seem traditionally what people would assume with Mexican food. How do you find that you have to maybe adapt untraditional ingredients to sort of those traditional styles, and maybe how do you adapt traditional ingredients to maybe unconventional styles of cooking?
Well, that's a good question. When we started the restaurant, I worried a lot more about whether a particular dish was Mexican enough or whether it wasn't, before realizing that that our flavor profile, our balance of seasoning, our choices in seasoning, really define the Mexicanness of the menu, so to speak. So, whereas your traditional sort of tools of balancing flavor are salt, acid, and sugar, and bitter, Mexican food is great in that high acid is very valuable, and harmonic with a lot of flavors. Spice really does magical things to certain types of flavors. Naturally sweet vegetables or fruits, different types of game might call for different types of chilies. Mm. And so really it's the approach to seasoning, I think, apart from the fact that, I'm Mexican and I'm cooking food, I define that as Mexican food, no matter what comes out. But our specific approach to seasoning and balance of seasoning, I think, lends the essential flavor to the dish or to the ingredient, no matter what it is. So as far as, sometimes, here in California, the agricultural richness of our markets is astounding, and there are certain things that aren't used in Mexican food. And so oftentimes, we look for things that that are analogous, look for ingredients that are analogous in Mexican cuisine, and try and recontextualize an ingredient. As an example, sunchoke season just wound down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never thought that sunchokes were eaten in Mexican cuisine. I had to do some digging to discover that, in fact, they were. The sunchoke is called the bataca in Spanish. And sure enough, it's used just like a potato.
Oh, wow.
So, because I love sunchokes, but previously I've only been familiar with sort of Italian or California cuisine implementations of that ingredient, I had to look for a way to incorporate that into the Mexican flavor profile. And so we chose the potato and chorizo, that sort of traditional pairing, as the basis for a dish with sunchokes.
Hmm.
That turned into roasted and caramelized sunchokes, sort of glazed with burnt sugar, for the potato. Over rather than chorizo, we made a blood chorizo. So, I love food from all cultures, and one of my favorite things in the world is very well made European style blood sausage.
Mm.
And so, the morcilla, that Spanish morcilla, there's an analog in Mexican food, moronga, or blood sausage, which is coarser and very aggressively seasoned. And then there's chorizo, and so we wanted to make a blood sausage. Yeah, a refined blood sausage in the European style, but that had the flavors of Mexican chorizo. A lot of chili, a lot of oregano, a lot of garlic, a little bit of acidity, and we arrived at something that was unconventional, but had a sort of the ghost of a familiar flavor profile.
Yeah, I mean, having had your chorizo dish, it's really fascinating to sort of see. And obviously, it's shiitake mushroom, correct? And it's not even meat, right?
Right. That's the other chorizo that we do. We've offered it during the evenings, but during the daytime, our vegetarian taco is a vegetarian chorizo. The chorizo itself is actually vegan. Shiitake mushrooms and rice, with all the traditional, well, except for pork fat, all of the traditional seasonings of a chorizo, and it tastes similar. It's not mimetics. We're not trying to fake it like veggie meats or vegan meats. We're not trying to create something that stands in place of meat. We were trying to create something that was delicious on its own, and wasn't attempting to stand in for another ingredient.
Maybe just capture the essence.
Exactly right. And so we got the richness and the umami from mushroom. We got the flavoring from all the traditional spices, like I mentioned, and the texture from rice and shiitake mushrooms, and it's really delicious, and people really like it.
Now, obviously, I think, you know, just for those, you know, listeners who aren't familiar with the restaurant, the name obviously might sort of throw people for a loop. Obviously, Taco Maria, people come maybe expecting a taco restaurant, when in reality you're serving, you know, a tasting menu with all of these, you know, various components, and then you also do tacos. But sort of maybe where did that name come from, and tell me a little bit about how you sort of handle that discord.
Sure. Well, actually, when we opened the restaurant initially, we weren't open for lunch, and we didn't serve a single taco. And there's two reasons for that. One is that, you know, contrary to how we look at it in how we look at Mexican food in the United States and really around the world, the taco itself isn't a dish. Whereas you can go to a restaurant now and order a set of tacos, you know, often with like rice and beans and other, you know, other sort of garnishes or sides, that's not something that you would traditionally really get in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
What you would get would be, you know, a plate of grilled meats or some guisados, you know, what we call the braises, you know, or a mix of these things, and the meal would be served with tortillas. And so the taco would be something that, the taco would be the act of eating, would be taking the tortilla and, you know, pinching off some of the chicken meat from the bone, or tearing off some of the carne asada, or dipping it into the broth of like a braise, like a birria or a barbacoa or something like that, or a tinga. And so it's sort of the tortilla itself is sort of a combination. It's a really interesting cultural artifact. It's sort of a combination of a utensil, also the primary starch, you know, Mexican culture, but also it's culturally very important, because the tortilla, coming from maize corn, which is an innovation of you know, the native people of North America and Central and Southern America, South America, it's really the reason for the existence of those cultures. It's really the reason that those cultures were able to flourish.
Yeah.
So every tortilla is in a sense sort of a representation of the driving force behind the development of those cultures. Not to overstate it, but
I think it's true. I think especially, you know, so many people, and you know, even for Western cultures, you know, and sort of here in the U.S., people associate, I think, food a lot of times with wheat. But I think that a lot of times, corn, people think of corn as high fructose corn syrup and sort of forget about how important corn is just as a food source. And sort of what you were mentioning about the sort of tortilla as a vehicle reminds me a lot of Ethiopian injera, just the bread and sort of, you know, both a sort of food in and of itself and also a utensil, sort of a vehicle for other foods. So that's really fascinating, man. Well, I know you have to get back to the restaurant, so I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And that's it. That's a wrap. That's season one. 13 episodes, incredible guests, so much fun. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to Create Cast. It's just been an absolute incredible journey, and I can't wait for you guys to hear season two. As I mentioned in the intro, it'll be about, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. Just going to take a little short break, do some more editing, do some more recording. In fact, I just recorded an awesome interview with a guy named Scott Menville, who is a voiceover artist who some of you might recognize as the voice of Robin from Teen Titans on Cartoon Network. So super cool, lots of fun stuff coming up, and I cannot wait. Also, of course, a huge thanks to Chef Carlos Salgado again. Amazing food, awesome chef. Make sure to get down there and get some of it. And obviously, make sure to visit us at createcastpod.com to find out more about our guests, see some exclusive photos, sign up for our email newsletter, and please rate, comment, and subscribe to us in the iTunes store to make sure that you can check out all of our old episodes and all of our new episodes coming up in season two. So once again, I'm your host, Chase Kay, and this has been CreateCast. And until next time, remember, make good.